Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Ken Hudnall Show. Ken has investigated the strange and unusual for over two decades. He's led ghost tours, and he's accessed the most haunted places in the Southwest. He's the author of some 40 books of the paranormal, unusual, hidden treasure, conspiracies, and the downright strange. His personal experiences and the experiences of many others are related on this show and in his many books. Please sit back, relax, and enjoy as Ken takes us into tales of terror, trauma, and triumph. And now, your host, Mr. Ken.
And good evening. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show right here on the one and only Blog Talk Radio, coming to you live from our studios in El Paso, Texas, gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, TGIF, folks, we've finally gotten to Friday. And this week is just about history. You know, there's a lot of issues that come up in this modern world we live in. And there's all kinds of major political trauma going on. I sit and try to do my show, and unfortunately, there are those that feel that they just can't live without trying to harass me. Well, you'll hear more about that in the very near future. Now, of course, there are quite a number of there are reasons that people single out others for harassment. They don't like them. They're jealous. And I've always said, since imitation is the most sincere form of flattery, I'm one of the most flattered people in town. And the border region is a region of cliques. Everybody's related to everybody. And you call in favors and you play the race card as often as you can, those who are in a position to do it. And you, of course, now, one way to get ahead is to let someone else build something up and then take it away from them, whether by force or using some of the sleazy bottom feeders that call themselves attorneys. But more on that as we move along. I've been asked a number of questions because I've made references to, the survival of some part of us after death. And I've had emails asking me for examples of the survival of some part of the human psyche. There's a story that I first heard it a number of years ago from a gentleman by the name of Frank Edwards, who he wrote about UFOs and he wrote about, strange things. I think he wrote UFO Serious Business, which is one of the first books I really enjoyed about UFOs. But this is from his um, writings about how strange the world is we live in. There was a number of years ago, there was a four-year-old boy who became involved in what was described at the time as one of the most incredible cases showing evidence of human survival after death. Dr. J.B. Ryan of the Ryan Institute, who was attached to Duke University, investigated this and found it absolutely solid case. There was a woman. Her husband had been a little bit older, and he owned a hotel. And they had a child, and unfortunately, unexpectedly, the father died. So the mother, of course, had to run the hotel, and there's always something requiring the owner's presence in running a hotel. So she was a widow. She had to operate the hotel. She had a four-year-old child. And, of course, not being able to afford child care, per se, and she did have something of a staff there at the hotel that kind of keep a half eye on him. The child spent a lot of time in the hotel lobby. And one evening, and this was about two and a half weeks after the father's death, the child had been given a pad of paper to draw pictures on. And he'd been set in front of one of the big windows in the lobby. And the mother several times passed by and noticed the child was diligently writing away on this pad of paper. And he filled three sheets with chicken scratch. And then he put him in his mother's mailbox at the hotel. Well, the next morning, one of the desk clerks went and got what was in the mother's mailbox and took it to her and noticed that what the mother thought was the child just doodling looked an awful lot like shorthand. Now, neither the mother nor the clerk could read shorthand. And if you've ever looked at something written in shorthand, it does look like chicken scratch. Now, a four-year-old child who can write shorthand, nah. The child's not going to pick up something like that. Now, there was a stenographer, a public stenographer, who had a lot of hotels in the city quite often have offices, at least on the ground floor. And one of them was a public stenographer. So the mother took the three pages of the child's doodling to the stenographer, and the stenographer assured him it did look like shorthand, but it was an obsolete method that hadn't been used in several years. But, you know, given time and the familiarity the stenographer had with shorthand in general, she was able to translate it. And she wrote it down, and they discovered it was an intelligent message. It began with a term of endearment that the father used when referring to his wife. And the message talked about some important papers, including bonds and insurance policies. They were in a safe deposit box in a New York bank, a bank the mother didn't know the father had a safety deposit box in. Well, taking the information, the mother went to that bank and discovered that indeed her husband did have a safety deposit box. And in that safety deposit box were the important papers that she had been looking for, because it was something of a financial crisis brought about with a debt. An expected death of the father. And there were bonds and there were insurance policies. Exactly what was said in the note. Now, what was the most interesting part of this little mystery is the fact that the father, a number of years ago, had been a stenographer himself and had used the obsolete form of shorthand in which the child wrote the message. If it was a message from the dead father, from beyond the grave, so to speak, it certainly strengthens the idea that there's life after death. And if it wasn't a message from beyond the grave, then we're left with another mystery. How would a four-year-old child know his father had a safety deposit box, know there are important papers, bonds, and insurance policy in it, and know enough obsolete shorthand to leave that message? Either way you look at it, it's a mystery. Now, we've talked over the last few days ago about past lives and children remembering. One of the most, one of the strongest cases for past life came out of India in 1944. Pramod Sharma was born in Basuli, India, in March of 44. He was the second son of a professor at the intermediate college. Now, when the child was 3 years old, he let the whole family know that he had decided to drop the name they'd given him, and he would be known by his real name, which is Pramanan. Well, when a three-year-old walks up and says, "Hey, this is not my name, this is my name," it does cause some confusion, I guess you could say. And that was just the beginning of a very strange episode. The child began to talk at great length about a Moradabad, which he had never been to. I mean, he was 3 years old. He had been right there in Basali. Now, his parents had heard stories about children who seemed to live before. And there was a very well-documented and thoroughly investigated case involving Shanti Devi, who at that time was alive and working in New Delhi. She had tried to go back and pick up the life she had left, and it just didn't work. It caused too much confusion and heartache among the family she remembered being part of. Now, hearing about a case which, of course, makes for a great discussion is one thing. When it's a member of your family, that's quite another. But the child talked incessantly about Moradabad and compared it with his life that he was living then. And he wanted his parents to take him to his former home. And he promised he would show his parents the fine bake shop he owned. And where there were good things to eat, far better than Basali. Well, the parents, of course, thought the child might be losing it. So, of course, they refused to take him. There was a tradition, there is a tradition in India that a reincarnated individual who remembers the past life doesn't usually live that long. But What made the parents decide to take him was when Ramanan, as he insisted on being called, came home late one day, and when his father asked him where he'd been, he said he'd just come from Chirarenpur, which is another area, and he added, my tummy got wet and I died, and now I have to come to Vaisali. Not quite the answer the father was expecting. I mean, he wanted to know why the child was late coming in, but that's neither here nor there. And later on, the child talked again about the fact he once owned a shop in Muradabad and that he had four sons and a daughter. And that his own name had been Mohan, and he'd been one of four brothers. His big fat wife, he asserted, still lived in Muradabad. And he kept insisting his parents take him so he could show them that he was telling the truth. Well, one August day, 1949, the professor took his son and some other relatives and went to Muradabad. They rode up on the train. Now, the professor had decided it was time to get to the bottom of this. He was going to test the child to see if perhaps he was playing some kind of pretend game and he had met someone from there who had told him all this information. And he wanted to see if his son could identify any of the places he talked about, or any of the people. Well, the boy passed the test with flying colors, to everyone's shock. He had never been to Muradabad since his birth. Of that, the parents were adamant. But he took his father and the relatives who came with him straight to the shop operated by the Mohan brothers. He took them to the soda water factory where, which the promenade had operated during life, and explained in detail how the carbonating machine worked. This is a five-year-old child. The lone ghostman has joined me. Well, since this five-year-old child was claiming that he had a family in that town, a wife and children, what's going on, Lone Ghostman? He was asked to identify his wife and children. This is a five-year-old child. Well, this five-year-old walked up to a crowd of people, pointed out the one he said was his wife, daughter, and the sons that he said were his. And they were, in fact, the wife, daughter, and sons of the late Ramanan. And he talked to them about things that no outsider would have known. And he answered their questions straight up and to the point. And he was correct. Among other things, he took them, what's on the show tonight? The Strange and the Unusual. Right now I'm talking about past lives. And we'll be talking about some ghosts. We'll be talking about UFOs. All kinds of bizarre things. He took them to the house where Ramanan had lived. Pointed out changes made since the death of the individual he claimed to be, including entire rooms that had been added to the house since the death. When it came time for him and his family to return to Vaisali, he didn't want to go. He wanted to stay with his wife and family.
Now, this is a five-year-old who remembers very clearly the life with his wife and children. And he didn't want to leave. He had to be forcibly taken out of the house and back to the train. Well, when the child was 19, he was interviewed, and he was still living with his, depending on your point of view, his real family in Basali, and he didn't quite know what to make of the idea of his early memories. Now, if you'll recall, I mentioned that he told his parents when he was Parmenon, his tummy got wet and he died. Well, investigation into medical records show that Parmenon was hospitalized for an undiagnosed abdominal ailment and was given a hot bath shortly before he died. He died at the age of 39. On May 9th, 1943. The child that claimed to be the reincarnated Parmenon was born March 15th, 1944 in Basali. Well, there's no doubt the child had the memories of the dead man. But think of the pain that caused both families. And if you're 5 years old, a little difficult to explain to wife and kids. And, you know, there's no going back. By the time he's of age to really do anything with the wife, you know, she's 20 years older. And when someone is dead and buried, think what a shock it is to see someone you don't recognize with the memories of the departed. And yet, how many cases like that have there been? And how many cases where people have memories of past lives that are looked at as fantasies and they're locked up for being schizophrenic? Well, you know, that's just one of the mysteries of this world. You know, sometimes people disappear for, to them, very good reasons. In fact, in this country alone, every year about 300,000 folks disappear. Sometimes they're dodgy bill collectors, sometimes it's a poor man's divorce they're trying to get, and sometimes they walk around the corner and are never seen again. It seems like they literally walk off the earth. And, you know, one of the most famous cases involved a farmer in Tennessee by the name of David Lang. He was walking across a field. A good friend of his, a judge, was driving along the road in his horse and buggy. Excuse me. The meal I didn't eat is causing me to hiccup. And his family was sitting on the front porch watching him. And then he stumbled and appeared to disappear. Of course, the assumption was he fell down and go boom. Well, his friend pulled over and jumped the fence and ran toward the spot. His family left the front porch and they ran toward the spot and he's gone. Never seen again. And it's not just individuals it happens to. There was an entire Eskimo village that vanished. Village called Anjikuni. Every man, woman, and child gone. Now, one thing an Eskimo will never let go of is his gun. Most of them have, of course, weapons for hunting, and they treat them like something precious because, frankly, they are. The weapons of every man in the village was leaning in the doorway of their huts. Kayaks were left rotting on the beach because this village was on the coast. The dogs, the sled dogs, which are treated as members of the family, were tied to trees and left to starve. Several investigations turned up exactly nothing. Absolutely no clue as to what happened to them. There were a few folks out on the tundra who reported seeing strange lights near the village. But nothing definitive. Now, if you'll check military records, you'll find a lot of mysteries that were never investigated. But there's one from the British military. July 24th, 1924. You know, I did a study in college of missing persons. Ran some computer simulations. Nothing compared to what could be done today, but you know, we had fairly decent systems. And I discovered something interesting about unexplained disappearances. Most happen on a Wednesday, and most happen on the 24th of the month. And when Wednesday falls on the 24th, it just goes wild. Well, this particular disappearance happened on the 24th of the month, July 24th, 1924. The deserts of the Middle East, which was then called Mesopotamia. Now, the Arabs were up in arms, and the British were keeping an eye on them whenever they could, and they were using the new airplanes that were making their way throughout the British military. Flight Lieutenant W.T. Day and Pilot Officer D.R. Stewart were flying a single-engine plane. It was a routine reconnaissance. They were expected to be gone about 4 hours. Well, they haven't been seen since. What are my thoughts on psychometry? Psychometry, for those of you who are not familiar with the term, is being able to pick up something and get impressions from it. Yeah, psychometry. Get impressions from it from about people who have owned it before. Some psychics who are known to use psychometry in trying to look for missing persons, there does seem to be a correlation. Now, there used to be, traveling shows, Houdini used to do it, and quite a number of other folks in vaudeville would do, their assistant would go through the audience and take items and hold them up, and the psychic, who usually was blindfolded, would tell them not only things about the object, but about the owner. Well, that's not psychometry. And actually, the assistant is using a code to tell the medium what the item is, and gives them information about the owner. Psychometry is when the psychic picks up the item and holds it in their hands. And I've seen a number of examples of psychometry that defy explanation. But it makes a type of sense because, you know, residual hauntings are thought to be the surroundings playing back emotional energy that has been absorbed by the surroundings. And certain people have the ability to play that back. That's why you see sometimes ghosts doing the same thing over and over and over and over and over. That's a residual haunting. Well, when someone who has that type of ability picks up, let's say, a set of car keys that they've never seen before, and they're able to hand it to the owner without hesitation, that's a type of psychometry. I saw a young lady, if you've ever been in a reserve officer training corps, you get handed a lot of manuals, and quite often you'll be given like the Ranger Handbook and things like that. And a lot of the manuals actually are recycled. They belong to other people who had turned them in. And the young lady in question picked up one of the Ranger Handbooks and proceeded to talk about the individual who had owned it and described him, described his military career. And I thought it was fascinating, so I went to the supply office and I asked, is there any way they could tell me where that handbook came from? Well, on one page in the back that I hadn't noticed, there was an address at Fort Lewis, Washington. And that address had been the home of the very individual she described. And she was very thorough. Now, I don't know that she had, or I don't know that she ever believed that she had psychic abilities, but certainly she demonstrated them that day. Now, getting back to the two British officers in the airplane in 1924, the plane was found several days later. It had been a safe landing. There was still gasoline in the tank. The engine fired right up when the rescuers tried to start it, and there was no sign the plane had been shot at. So there was no clue as to why they had landed. There was a broad stretch of desert. There was no water anywhere around. No oasis, no city, no ruins, no nothing. Now, there was a search party that actually on foot combed a large area of that desert. There was so little wind that the boot marks of the two pilots could still be seen beside the aircraft. Psychometry, term coined by Joseph Rhodes Buchanan, to refer to the practice in which sensitives hold an object in their hands and obtain paranormal information about the object or its owner. Owing to the confusion with a psychological term, psychome. I go along with that. There are a lot of people who have turned things like that into parlor games. As I say, in vaudeville, there was a code between the assistant and psychometry has in recent years been superseded by token object reading. Political correctness, that's all that is. Now, the track showed the two officers under their own steam walked away from the plane and stopped about 40 yards away. And they were standing side by side. And at that point, the tracks end.
Now, there was never any clue what happened to the two officers. Armored trucks, other planes, and a dozen or so desert patrols of native tribesmen scoured the desert looking for the officers or their bodies. Just another unexplained disappearance. You know, there are many mysteries that we will never have the answers to. I've talked about two thus far. You know, science tells us what's possible. For example, paleontologists and archaeologists have put together a timeline of what was. But what happens when what was is disproven? There were four prospectors back in 1877, and they were prospecting in at the head of Spring Valley near Eureka, Nevada. Now, it so happens the book that I'm finishing up is The History and Mystery of Sin City. There's a lot of mysteries in Nevada. And they were picking their way through this area looking for some clue that the valuables they sought might be beneath the sand. Now, one of the men noticed something odd about a ledge of rock right near where he was picking up samples. And out of curiosity, he climbed up to a point where he could get a better look at that protrusion, as he called it, and was amazed to find what looked like the leg bone of a human, broken off just above the knee. Now, that leg bone was thoroughly embedded in the rock, so he got his friends to come help him actually chisel it out. What is proof? Is there proof of anything in paranormal? To scientific standards, no, because in science it must be reproducible in the laboratory. Quite a number of things happen in the great outdoors. Very few people wander around with cameras 24/7. A number of strange events we only know of through word of mouth. So how do you prove a psychic's ability? Hindsight. Robert McKnight, before 9/11, talked about 9/11. I wrote about it in 1993. People dreamed about it. I've had a number of people tell me about dreams they had about 9/11. The sinking of the Titanic. There were stories written several years before the sinking that were identical to what happened. And one of them, the ship was called the Titan. In real life, it was the Titanic. Well, these prospectors took some small rock picks, and they dug out that bone. The bones were solidly set in rock that was as hard as rock. The bones were almost black. They were so old. And when the last of the stone had been knocked loose, you had a leg bone still with the foot attached that was in fairly good condition. It had the knee joint, the kneecap, the lower leg bone, and the complete bones of the foot. Well, they noticed the unusual size of this lower leg that they had found. From the knee to the heel was 39 inches. So the man that came from was a veritable giant. Now, they realized they had made a to find it might prove to be profitable. So they brought it to Eureka, and it went on display in a store window. Several doctors examined the leg bone and said there was no doubt it was human, incredibly old, and definitely the leg of a giant. Now, there's a number of stories about this in the Eureka, Nevada newspaper, and some of these stories were picked up in other parts of the country. Two museums sent representatives out to try to find the rest of the skeleton, but they came away empty-handed. Just the leg bone and the foot, nothing more. You know, in the world of archaeology, such frustrations, I guess, are quite common. There was a strip coal mine in Hammondsville, Ohio, in 1868. Or another oddity turned up. A workman knocked loose a huge mass of coal that fell into the pit, and what was left behind was a large, smooth slate wall covered with hieroglyphics. The lines were about 3 inches apart, and it was just top to bottom hieroglyphics. Now, nobody could read the hieroglyphics, and unfortunately, by the time proper scholars arrived to investigate, the slate wall had crumbled away in the exposure to the air, and of course, the curious trying to get their little piece of what may well be history. You know, here in Texas, there have been a number of unusual stories. But one story kind of stands out. It's Josiah Wilbarger was the man. He was a school teacher, and this took place in LaGrange, Texas. It's about 1838, Alamo's in 36. And at the time he had this rather unusual experience, he was visiting with his friend who lived on a farm near what's now the city of Austin. Now, Wilbarger was looking to relocate, and he thought it might be a good idea to settle near his friend. So he wanted to look the land over and pick out a good place for his farm. So four locals said they'd take him and show him around, and one morning he rode out, and they hadn't gone more than a couple of miles before a member of the party spotted an Indian sitting on his horse on a nearby ridge just watching. Now, of course, they waved to the Indian, but he didn't return their greetings. So they decided to check him out, because in 1838, there were still Indian problems in Texas. So as they rode closer, the Indian turned and left at a gallop, and they followed. But they lost him in the trees that covered the hillside. Well, they returned in the direction from which they'd come, and they stopped at a small creek. Because, let's face it, Texas at any time is hot. So they picketed their horses and filled up on creek water, which was cold and pure, and sat down to talk, which wasn't exactly, shall we say, the smartest thing they could have done. They've been there a few minutes when they were literally overrun by Indians who had been hiding in the thicket. Two members of the party were killed immediately. Two others scrambled to their feet, fired a couple of shots, and dove into the bushes.
You ever heard of the stories of American soldiers using dowsing rods to find tunnels that were built by Vietnamese soldiers? Had some success.
Yes, I've heard about that. A number of tunnel rat stories deal with the use of dowsing rods. Dowsing rods, for those not familiar with them, usually are from the ash or oak trees. And one end is shaped like a Y, and the dowser holds in each hand one of those legs of the Y. And the supposedly, as they're usually used for water finding. They're called water witches, those that can find water. And they'll feel tremble in the branch as they get close to the water. And there are many who say it's clairvoyance, as a lone ghostman observes in the chat room. Others say it's an ability to distinguish ground waves. You know, if you're finding a tunnel, for example, that's different than the surrounding land. So you get a different response from your dowsing rod over an empty area than you will over solid ground. And the same is true with water, because where the water is at, you don't have solid ground, so there's going to be different vibrations, I guess you could say. Some say the rods are props. I've seen dowsing rods used for treasure hunting, and in some cases, especially with someone who is an experienced dowser, there's as much success with the dowsing rod as there is with the metal detector. And a dowsing rod is a hell of a lot cheaper. Dowsing rods are also used sometimes for finding ghosts. I saw that demonstrated in Nevada. Well, Will Barger was hit in the back with two arrows, but he joined the two that were hot-footing it out of there. Then there was a rifle shot that really staggered Will Barger. He was hit in the throat. And he collapsed. And as far as his friends knew, he was dead. So they left him there and continued to hot-foot it toward the nearest town. Now, the Indians robbed the bodies and mutilated them. They scalped them, the first two men. And when it came to Will Barger, they thought he was dead, and they stripped him of his clothes, and they scalped him, and he was still alive. Now, I might make note of the fact that the we read in history and we've heard in movies about Indian scalping. That was not a Native American practice prior to the arrival of the Spaniards. The Spaniards and later on the Mexican government found the Native Americans to be a pest. And they were superb horsemen, some of the best light cavalry the world's ever seen. So a bounty was put on Native American members of the tribes. And rather than bring back the bodies of the Indians you killed, it was easier just to scalp them and bring back the scalps. And of course, the Indians got tired of that very quickly, and they started returning the favor. So scalping did go on. It wasn't exactly, shall we say, a well-respected practice, but it did go on both sides. Now, Wilberger laid there for several hours. I mean, getting hit with two arrows and shot in the throat with a rifle and being scalped, and he had to have a hell of a sunburn since they stripped him. That takes something out of you. It was almost dark when he regained his senses, and he was covered with blood, so weak he couldn't stand up. And Texas and the prairie at night, I don't care what time of year it is, it's cold. And so he crawled into the brush for warmth, such as it was. But he was determined he wasn't going to die. And he knew he was about 6 miles from where his friend lived, and he dragged himself along. He made about a half mile, and then he gave up. And he was only half conscious. He was bloody, and he can be forgiven for having what might have been an illusion or hallucination. His sister, who lived in Missouri, appeared right in front of him and said, Josiah, that was his first name, you're 2 weeks to go on. Just stay where you're at, and somebody will come get you before the sun sets the next day. Well, somebody in that condition, of course, these hallucinations or illusions look real. So he begged her to stay, and she shook her head and smiled and walked away in the direction of his friend's home. Now, his two companions that got away made their way to the friend's house and reported that Wilberger was dead, along with the other two that had been with him. And, you know, there certainly it was understandable they'd report him dead, because the nature of the wounds were such that, frankly, he had to be dead. There wasn't no two ways about it. But that night, the friend's wife had a dream, a very realistic, full-blown, living-color nightmare, frankly. She saw Wilberger lying in the dirt beneath the brush, caked with blood, naked, scalped, but she saw he was still alive. Well, she woke up and realized she was having a nightmare, but she went back to sleep, had the same identical dream again. So she woke up her husband and insisted that the two that had arrived and her husband go back and look for Wilberger. She knew he was alive. Well, the three tried to reason with her, and you know, sure that a dream like that was to be expected when someone close to you is killed in such a horrible fashion. But like most women, when she makes up her mind, they couldn't have got that idea out of her head with gunpowder. So finally, they agreed they'd go back, armed themselves, and left at dawn. They knew the search was going to be useless. They might recover his body, but that was it. Now, they found the place where the ambush had taken place, and they searched the area, and after a while, they actually found Wilberger's trail and found him propped up against a scrubby cedar stump. He looked like he was death warmed over, but he was still living. So they took him over to the stream, washed him, and
treated his wounds as best they could, wrapped him in a blanket, and started back to the settlement. Well, Wilbarger recovered and lived for another 11 or 12 years. But there was no doubt about his rescue was entirely because of her dream and the insistence that he was still alive. But the most puzzling part of this episode was Wilbarger's sister, who appeared to him as he lay bloody and collapsed in the scrubs. She had died at her home in Missouri 24 hours before she appeared to Wilbarger. One of the most unusual cases on record. You know, it was September 1956 when the Calavani brothers in Westport, Connecticut were digging in the family burial plot at Green's Farm Congregational Church. There was, for those who might not be familiar with the old cemetery custom, back when families were much larger, you would buy, if you didn't have a family cemetery close to your home, wherever the family was going to be buried, usually at the church they all attended, they would buy sizable plots suitable for burying two or three generations. And when all those burial sites had been used, they'd buy another plot. Well, the Calavani family had one more burial possible in the original burial plot. It was a spot that had been marked out. There was no member of the family buried there. Kelly Roy, you've joined us. I appreciate that. Well, as they dug down, getting ready to bury another member of the family, to their shock, they found a coffin where no coffin was supposed to be. And when they opened that coffin, they discovered it contained the body of a man they had never seen before. He was, in fact, it looked like he was asleep, well preserved. He was about 40, 45 years old, dressed in a very expensive blue suit. And the suit appeared to have been freshly pressed. And the coffin was an expensive one. Usually, well, in the 1800s, especially here in El Paso, someone died and they had money, they might be buried in a plywood coffin, which over time would, of course, deteriorate and fall apart. If they didn't have money for the coffin, they might be wrapped up in their bed clothing and thrown in a hole. Or they might be, if they were a cowboy and wearing a duster, which was, you know, quite often worn, they might be wrapped up in the duster and thrown in a hole. But this guy was in a very expensive coffin. Now, they had owned that burial plot for some time, and there was no sign of the ground having been disturbed when they started digging, so it was something of a mystery. So the question was, who was he, and how did he come to be buried in the family burial plot? Well, since he couldn't be identified, they couldn't get a permit from the court to let them dig him up and move him. So the Calavani brothers covered
the coffin back up. And they went and raised hell with the cemetery authorities. I mean, it was their burial plot. Why was somebody else buried there? And it appeared to have been a recent burial because the suit was still freshly pressed and the body had not deteriorated. Well, they got the police involved, they got the court involved, and finally the police couldn't find another excuse not to investigate. So they dug up that mysterious coffin. They found the coffin, or a coffin. But when they opened it up, instead of a well-preserved body, they found a skeleton. It had been there at least 50 years, according to the necrologists, which are those that study the dead. Now, two of the brothers were adamant that was not the coffin they had dug up a few months before. And it wasn't a body they had found. And the police just shrugged and put the skeleton back where they found it. So that left a lot of questions. Had the body the brothers found been that of a murder victim hidden in a, what was the last place anybody would look, and had accidentally discovered it, and had the killer found out that the body had been discovered and replaced it with another, or was it the same body that had deteriorated rapidly after being exposed to the air? And that does happen. Or some believe the brothers saw the dead man as he had been and not as he was. Well, the law says that until he's identified, he cannot be exhumed and moved. So he may never be moved from that cemetery. You know, there are psychics claim to see the future. I've done very well predicting the past. But that's an entirely different story. But there was an interesting individual. His name was Spencer Thornton. He had a very unique talent. He could predict newspaper headlines days or even weeks ahead of publication. And that was puzzling everybody and upsetting the reporters. The Times Herald from Dallas, Texas decided to get to the bottom of the matter. Spencer Thornton was a doctor. He wasn't a 29, but he was gaining a hell of a reputation for being able to predict the future, because since the newspapers wrote about things that happened contemporaneously, if he could predict the headline, then he could predict the future. So they gave him a challenge. And he accepted. So, a staff writer by the name of Paul Rosenfeld met Dr. Thornton and said, okay, write out for me, you know, prove you can predict headlines. So Thornton wrote down a few lines on a piece of paper and put it in an envelope addressed to Mr. Rosenfeld at the newspaper. And Rosenfield sealed the envelope and personally put it in the mail to himself. So there couldn't be any fraud. So after the letter was safely in the mailbox, Thornton said that he had answered three questions which he hadn't yet asked the newsman. Number one, how much money was in Rosenfield's pockets? And Dr. Thornton wrote down $4.45. And question number two, what was Rosenfield's hometown? Dr. Thornton wrote down Clarksville, Texas. And he asked Rosenfield to think of a number between 1 and 1,000. And Rosenfield replied that he was thinking of 632. Well, when the newsman got to the Times Herald office the next day, the letter was waiting. He opened it up and found that Dr. Thornton had written down in advance, without even asking the questions, the correct answer to the last two questions, hometown and any number up to 1,000. He had gotten an incorrect answer to the first question. He missed by one penny. Now, that's got to have caused a lot of sleepless nights for folks figuring out how he did that. You know, sometimes even though most of us try to be open-handed and fair, outsiders don't get a fair shake. In the Welsh town of Montgomery, several hundred people gathered to watch the execution of a young Englishman. He'd been convicted of stealing the purse on the highway, and the crowd was certainly not friendly to the young man. The Welsh were known for being clannish, as are those people in certain parts of our country. Now, the young man's name was John Davies. And he'd been brought to town, as was the case quite often in England, to help a local widow run her farm. Now, farming in good conditions is tough, but Wales is not exactly a Garden of Eden. Lots of kids died. Well, that's quite true. Davies had been very successful at turning the farm around until he was attacked on the road by two locals who demanded his money. And he refused, and a fight started. Well, 2-1 odds are rarely good. And this was not Chuck Norris, so he got his ass whipped pretty good. And to add insult to injury, the two thieves took him to the police and charged him with trying to rob them. Well, in many communities, hell, I live in one, everybody's related to everybody, unless you're from the outside, in which case you looked at with suspicion. Well, a local jury looked at this outsider and agreed that he was probably guilty. and he was sentenced to death. And on the scaffold, because in those days when you were found guilty, scaffold was waiting. He raised his hand and said, thought of the wrong story. It happens. He said, I'm going to die, praying to God that he will let no grass grow on my grave, and that will prove my innocence. And the hangman, who was had a pint waiting for him at the local tavern, immediately hit the switch, and John Davies died. He was buried in the Montgomery Parish churchyard, but then folks forgot. But then, rumors began to circulate. Folks who went by the churchyard saw that, as is usually the case, grass had sprung up in the cemetery, and every grave but one was covered with grass. His was just dirt. And the rumors started. Now, the powers that be, realizing that here was proof positive that they'd screwed up, had the grave covered with sod. They weren't going to admit that hung an innocent man. Well, the sod promptly died. So they sowed grass seed. A lot of grass seed. Not a single seed sprouted. Davies was executed September 6, 1821, and he was buried the same day. In 1851, the cemetery was remodeled. The existing graves were covered over with 2 feet of fresh soil, and grass seed was sown all through the cemetery. In 2 weeks, what had been a graveyard was now a beautiful lawn, except for the area right above Davy's grave. So a crew came in and they put more sod and they fertilized it, and once again the sod died. Finally, the vicars of the church gave up. So they fenced in the grave of John Davies, and to this day, if you go to the Welsh town of Montgomery, you're going to see that barren gravesite. Proof that he had not been a criminal. History doesn't report what happened to the two thieves, but I'm sure that in some fashion they got their just desserts. You know, people always talk about karma and what goes around comes around, and now crime pays. Crime pays very well. It's only when people get greedy and somebody doesn't think he got his just desserts that sometimes karma works. You know, the Field Natural History Museum in Chicago is a show place. It's surrounded by smooth, well-kept green lawns. All except one spot, which is a patch of just dead ground. And there's a very strange story that goes along with that patch of barren earth. In 1956, the resident curator of the Field Museum had an assistant who was, they were working in the unheated basement of the building. The day was cool, unseasonably so. But the assistant complained of being too warm. He told the curator he was going outside to cool off. So he laid down on the grass. And when the curator checked on him, discovered he had suffered a heart attack. Well, fortunately, he recovered from that heart attack, and 6 years after the incident, that particular spot on the lawn where he had laid and had that heart attack was barren ground, though the grass was full and lush and thick all around it. And even though the soil has been removed to a depth of 2 or 3 feet and replaced, no grass will grow in that particular spot. Now, each spring, the grass does sprout there, but it withers and dies. Science says this can't happen. The only problem is it does. You know, interestingly enough, Wilbur and Orville Wright, a couple of bicycle repairmen, believed heavier-than-air flight was possible. Now, science said it wasn't. They flew at Kitty Hawk the first time in December 1903. But as late as January of 1906, Scientific American published an editorial that said the Wright airplane and its fabled performance. According to the Scientific American, the journal of science in this country, if such sensational and tremendously important experiments were being conducted in a not very remote part of the country, on a subject with almost everybody feels is of the most profound interest, is it possible to believe that the enterprising American reporter, who it is well known, comes down the chimney when the door is locked in his face, even if he has to scale a skyscraper to do so, would not have ascertained all about him and published it long ago? In other words, hello, Kelly Roy. In other words, because it wasn't written about already, it can't be true. Such is the interest science has. Now, another topic that science is very silent about is UFOs. Now, in May of 1962, there were two very well-documented, though widely separated, reports of UFOs. Newspapers in Europe and South America reported these stories in detail. Let me see here. But the news services in the United States ignored them,
as they routinely ignore stories of this type. It was the last week of May in 1962. Maximum visibility. There wasn't a cloud in the sky. An Irish International Airlines Viscount jet passenger liner was flying from Cork to Brussels. Plane was flying at 17,000 feet, about 55 miles from Bristol, England. Ground speed was about 600 miles an hour. The pilot was a veteran. Spotted an object coming toward his plane and beneath it. Every member of the crew and all the passengers, and a good many of the passengers, saw this object. Now, the captain said in the written report he turned in, and this was unique in itself, that a pilot would write a report about a UFO. He said, "I've never seen anything like it. I've been flying for 30 years. About 3,000 feet below me, coming at about 500 miles an hour." And this is a 30-year pilot. He knows what he's talking about. It was brown, disc-shaped, had 8 or 10 antenna-like projections around its rim. Radar picked it up on the ground, and it suddenly darted up and away and vanished. May 24th, remember what I said, most disappearances happen on the 24th of the month, and it happens on Wednesday. Now, it doesn't give us a specific date about the one in Europe, but the one in May 24th, 1962, Argentinian Air Force disclosed it was deeply concerned by two sightings in remote parts of that country. Now, one case they reported dealt with a very wealthy woman who owned a large ranch. A disc-shaped craft landed near her home, and she went out to get a close look at it. Now, the official Argentine statement didn't give details on what the woman reported that she saw, except to say she suffered from shock and is flown by an Air Force hospital to the helicopter to the nearest hospital. And reporters were not permitted to get near her. And a second Argentine incident took place 2 days after the first one. 18 Army men and 3 officers building a bridge over a small stream in southeastern Argentina reported watching a silvery disc-shaped thing that settled down in a meadow, not too different to them. "A man slammed into me at a red light today and had to go to the hospital due to whiplash. No health insurance. Then my car overheated and broke down on the way home. Sometimes life is too funny." Well, I wouldn't call it funny, but I'm glad you're all right. I'd hate to lose a listener. You know, along the same vein as the story in Wales, humans have a tendency to ostracize those that look or act different. Look at the witchcraft trials. I healed myself at the hospital and I'm good as new. The other guy's insurance may help me get a new car. But if he was at fault, it sure as hell should. In Bucksport, Maine, There's a visible memento of the days when New England was in the throes of its witch-hunting frenzy. Now, keep in mind, the only real proof of the existence of witches were two hysterical teenage girls. And in the normal course of events, their stories would have been probably ignored, but there was an individual known as the Witch Finder in New England back in those days. And his claim to fame was he could find witches. If he didn't find witches, he didn't get paid. So what's he going to do? He's going to find witches. There were so many communities back in those days persecuting people for allegedly being witches. And Colonel Jonathan Buck, the founder of Bucksport, decided his little community shouldn't be overlooked. So he decided Bucksport was going to prosecute its witches. Though, frankly, I think it was probably persecute. You know, a little quick story to show you how the human mind works. Back in mid to late 1700s, a lot of the young men who attended higher education were the offspring of the nobility. And one young man thought it would be fun to mystify the locals. So he took a piece of paper and he wrote on that piece of paper gibberish. And he folded it up and he put it in a little knick-knack that he had picked up for a few shillings at a store. And he told everyone that that was a magical charm. And with that magical charm, he could make cows quit giving milk and hens quit laying. And so you shouldn't mess with him. And you know, he graduated, and eventually his father, the Earl, died, and he assumed the title. And it was no worse than any of the other headstrong youth of that day. And eventually he became a crown judge. And he rose very high in His Majesty's service. Well, there was a law passed. Did you class Nostradamus a witch? He healed many people with natural mole. Don't forget Clark's Law. Any science sufficiently advanced is indistinguishable from witchcraft. He was ahead of the curve. Got some of that in my shower. That can happen. But you have a very healthy shower. Anyway, the England passed a law outlawing witches. And a case came before him where this old maiden lady was accused of being a witch, and she had cursed her neighbor's cows and chickens. Cows quit giving milk, chickens quit laying. So under that new law, she was arrested and brought before the judge. And the witnesses against her said that she had this charm
this magical charm that would let her curse others. And the judge said, well, show me this charm. What they handed him was the knick-knack that he had bought so many years ago when he was in college. And inside that knick-knack was that page of gibberish he had written out. Needless to say, he dismissed the case. But the point remains, it's fear and superstition. Not to mention a feeling of, you're not from around here, so you've got to be, if anybody's at fault, it's you. Because nobody from here would do that. We're talking about Bucksport. The popular stereotype of a witch was an old lady with a prominent chin and eccentric habits. What was it? My screen crashed. Gray Artist, you've joined us. I appreciate that. We're talking about the strange and the unusual. Right now I'm talking about witchcraft. Well, the colonel went about his community and he pointed out the ones he knew were witches. And she begged and she pleaded. Oh, the thing that she had the knick-knack that the judge had bought as part of his prank all those many years ago. And in it was the page of gibberish she had written out that was supposed to be a magical charm. It was all bogus. Well, this old woman pleaded with the colonel. She wasn't a witch. How dare he? But he was positive. He was a very self-righteous individual. And if he pointed out somebody as a witch, then by God, she was a witch. And lying about it only made it worse, and her lying proved that she was a witch. So he ordered she be tortured until she confessed. Well, for several hours, she was tortured. But she wouldn't admit she was a witch. And finally the colonel got tired of the whole thing and said, well, just execute her. Well, she was conscious right to the very end, and with her last breath, she cursed the colonel and his friends and declared that when he died, his tombstone would bear the print of her foot as evidence. He killed an innocent woman. Well, Colonel Buck never forgot that threat. And at the time of his death, the heirs took very special pains to carry out his instructions that the tombstone be flawless, unblemished, without a single flaw. And that's what he got, a very imposing monument to show future generations how important he was. And it was placed at the head of his grave about 2 months after he died. A snowy white stone, huge, as befitted the founder of the community and one of its wealthiest citizens. Well, the caretaker of the cemetery, what they called in those days the sexton, was the first to notice the change that took place. He called the minister, and the minister called Buck's relatives, and sure enough, there on that white, flawless white stone was the faint outline of a woman's foot. And each day it got darker and plainer. Now, the family called the stonemason and had him carefully scrape away that reminder of the old lady that had been murdered by Buck. But in a few weeks, that footprint came back. And crowds of the curious grew. And rumors began to spread. So the heirs got together and decided they were going to have that tombstone removed and replaced with a new one, a brand new one. Well, the second stone was put in place. In a few weeks, there was that footprint. At that point in time, the heirs gave up. The stone is still there, and if you ever go to Bucksport, Maine, you can see it. And the footprint is still there. A lasting reminder of the evil that men do. You know, there was a head-on collision between two trains back in 1904. Robert Musgrove was an engineer who died in that collision. And he is buried in the cemetery of the Musgrove Chapel Methodist Church in Fayette County, Alabama. Been there. Well, now let's see what we got here. Let me see if we have idiots or if we have legitimate callers. You're on the Ken Hudnall Show.
Oh, good evening, Ken. How are you doing? My name is Michael, and you know, I'm listening to some of these subjects you're bringing up. I was wondering, like when it comes down to the theory of making a sandwich, you found.
We have idiot number one. And this new button. Yeah, they're tracing him now. You're on the Ken Hudnall Show.
Oh, hey there, Ken. I actually want to talk about the escapades. I mean, there's a big thing out here about the escapades, man. And you make me a sandwich fest.
Idiot number two. You know, it amazes me that what sound like adults have nothing better to do than act like jackasses. And I'm sure if they were doing a show and I did something like that, they would just be up in arms and beside themselves. Well, let's see. It appears that we have one person who certainly would like to be kicked off. I don't put up with jackasses. I try to do the best show I can for the listeners. If you don't want to listen to me, there's 10,000 other shows you can listen to, or you can go outside and beat your head against a brick, which is about the mentality you've got. Well, at the time Robert Montgomery died, he was engaged to be married to a young lady from Amory, Mississippi. Been down there, too. And for months after his funeral, she made frequent visits to his grave. And she'd kneel in prayer for as much as an hour at a time. Now, no one really knows what happened to her. She may have met someone else. She may have had an accident. But by 1960, the tombstone over his grave had turned dark. You know, out in the elements, that happens. Now, it was an 8-foot high shaft of marble. And many people noticed what appeared to be a
image appearing on that stone. And it was that of a young woman. Now, the stone had turned dark with age. I mean, we're talking about almost 60 years. But the outline of the woman was much lighter. In fact, by 1963, you could see it from the road. It was the likeness of a young woman in a bridal gown. At least they could be clever and add to the conversation. And I agree with you. You know, it's getting old. This, all they want to do is yell profanities and racial slurs. Clearly, they've never grown up. And after the 18th, when I moved to the new network, when I ban somebody, they are banned for life. And the system will be checking ISPs. And it doesn't make any difference how many masks they put in front. The system will track them. Some of the best software I've ever seen. Now, the hairstyle was can be distinguished, and even the eyelashes on the figure. Each succeeding year, that figure becomes more clear. So if you want to go to the Musgrove Chapel, you can see it yourself. It's outside of Winfield, Alabama. You know, there's another tombstone that's puzzled people. Well, we got another caller. I'll give them any. They're persistent, if nothing else. You're on the Ken Hudnall Show.
Oh, hey, what's going on?
Just doing a show.
Hey, I was just wondering, what's your favorite kind of stamp?
Idiot number three. You know, there's a, in Williamston, North Carolina, there's a tombstone that's published that has puzzled a lot of people. It bears the name of James Huff. And the date of his burial was October 13th, 1901. Now, on that stone is the etched outline of a horse's head, which is kind of interesting when you consider how he died. Now, he was fond of his horse. Well, let's see. You're on the Ken Hudnall Show.
Hi, I'm Felix.
Some folks just don't give up. And he took very good care of this horse. And one evening he hitched it to a buggy, and he went for a ride. The next morning, his battered body was found beside the overturned buggy on a country road. The horse was missing and was never found. Well, it was about 2 months after the burial, somebody going by the cemetery. Sure, it wasn't the horse's aunt. Well, yeah, it could well have been. And gradually the outline of that horse's head became more clear. There are no cracks in the stone to form the image, no scratches, no marks. It just appeared. Can horses regret what they do? I don't know. You know, this hour is brought to you by The Garden, 511 Western, right here in El Paso, down in the Warehouse District. Food is absolutely some of the best you'll see. They got everything from sushi to absolutely superb hamburgers. And, you know, they try to please. If there's something you would like, just tell them. They do their best to make it a meal you'll enjoy, so you come back. The same people also own Jeske's Fire Grill on Lee Trevino in the Sun Point Shopping Center. No, Town Center Shopping Center. And now that is a great club. In the evenings, they have dancing. On the weekends, they got some outstanding music. In fact, the music is so much a part of it that some of the neighbors get a little testy. But that's because the place is so popular. If you go in and tell them you hear about it on the Ken Hutnell Show, and I'll appreciate it greatly. You know, there's a number of stories that come out of California that are fairly interesting. Well, a man named Meehan, he was 38 at the time, considered himself a ladies' man, and many people said he was handsome. He was an attorney who enjoyed a very profitable private practice, and he was counsel for the California Employment Department. Now, this was back in his 60s. Now, his private practice, his office, was in Concord, California. And he'd been in Eureka doing a series of employment cases and TGIF, he was heading home. And he left Eureka about 2 p.m. And he thought, he made a comment to some folks. He thought he was coming down with the flu. He really wasn't feeling that great. He got to Myers Flats, which is a little hole in the road. There's a bar there, and he stopped for a drink. And he telephoned his wife and told her he felt ill and he'd probably be late getting home. And she advised him to stop at a motel instead of trying to drive when he didn't feel well. And so he got to Redway, which is another little hole-in-the-wall place, but it does have a motel. It's called the 40 Winks. And he decided to stop. Now, this is a couple of miles north of Garbageville, which was, like the county seat, kind of the center of what went on in that area. Now, he made arrangements to spend the night at the 40 Winks, and he drove over into Garbageville, which was the closest hospital. He told a nurse, I feel like I'm dead. Well, the nurse was making some preliminary checks on him, and before the doctor had a chance to examine him, he disappeared. About 6:45 in the evening. Just vanished. Now, at about 7 p.m., a couple living in Myers Flats reported to the State Highway Patrol they'd just seen the taillights of a speeding car on Highway 101 vanish into the waters of the Eel River. So the state police immediately sent a car to the scene. Now at 8 o'clock, 6:45, Tom Meacham vanishes from the hospital. 7 o'clock, the car is seen driving into the river. 8 o'clock, Tom Meehan walks into the 40 Winks Motel and runs into the owner and says, "Do I look like I'm dead? I feel like I died. And the whole world died with me." Now, the owner noticed that the guy's shoes and the lower 3 or 4 inches of his pant legs were wet, but didn't say anything. And Meehan went on into his room. Well, at 9:30, the bellboy went to his room and to Meehan's room to tell him the call he had placed to his wife in Concord couldn't be completed because a storm disrupted the service. And the bellboy noticed the man had changed into a black suit and a white shirt.
At 10:45, Meehan's car was found in the Eel River, submerged up to the taillights, which was still burning. There's blood on top of the car, and a trail of bloody footprints led up the bank and toward the highway where they just stopped. There was nobody in the submerged car, and it had gone into the water at high speed. Now, Meehan was not at the 40 Winks Hotel, though his clothes were there, as well as his suitcase. The wet suit and shoes weren't wet and showed no signs of having been wet. There wasn't a speck of mud on them. Meehan had vanished. He disappeared on the night of February 1st. And the next time he was seen was February 20th, when his body was found 16 miles downriver from the spot where the car had gone into the water. An autopsy showed he had drowned. His head had been gashed, but the wound was superficial. And he had survived the crash into the water, only to drown later. Now here's the puzzle. If Meehan got on the riverbank safely and then stumbled back into the river, which is what the evidence at the scene showed, how had the owner and the bellboy at the motel seen him later? How could he have gone back to the hotel and cleaned up and then drowned later in the river several miles away? Well, the state police did not doubt the identification of Meehan at the motel. Both the manager and the bellboy saw and talked with him. So we got a case of a man being in two places at one time, which science says can't happen. But the facts say it did. Go figure. You know, one of the big mysteries that hasn't been even close to being solved is who was the first in America. It's fairly certain that the Indians who inhabited North America at the time Columbus arrived were fairly recent newcomers. Now, there's a lot of bits and pieces of evidence, none of which are definitive by any means, that point to the existence of earlier cultures that became fairly sophisticated and widespread. On top of Medicine Mountain in the Bighorn Range in Wyoming, there are strange symbols that have been placed there. There's a circle of stones, 70 feet in diameter, carefully laid out in a perfect geometric form. The stones are arranged to form 28 spokes radiating from a hub, 12 feet in diameter, with a 7-foot open space in the center. And around the wheel, there are 6 huge stones that seem to have served as chairs for the high priest of the people who built this unusual monument. Now, the Indians had no use for the wheel and no idea of how it got there, but they knew it was there, of course. White men first became interested in the design in 1902 when the Field Museum of Chicago spent a lot of time trying to unravel the mystery. S.C. Sims was the representative of the museum, and he was determined to get to the bottom of the matter, but the only thing he could conclude is it was a religious symbol of some race that existed in that area. My last story was a crisis apparition. I agree. But hindsight is 20/20. When you're there dealing with the results of someone being in two places at the same time, it can get extremely baffling. Well, Sims concluded that the race had existed in that area between 15,000 B.C. and 1,000 B.C., which meant it was older than the Egyptians. Apparently, the only surviving evidence of their passing, according to Lone Ghostman, a crisis apparition is the most common of apparitions that appear to loved ones and close friends within 48 hours of death and are known to stay around as ghosts for no longer than a few days. But this man did not appear to close friends and relatives. He appeared to a nurse at the hospital and to the owner and the bellboy at the hospital, at the motel. In the moment of death clocks, watches have been known to clack, stop, break. Okay. Now, the Sacramento Bee reported that a resident of Sacramento has a rock that is elaborately carved, and a lot of other stones, some of them weighing up to 800 pounds, have been found in hydraulic diggings, placer mines, a lot of those in California. Some were washed out from places that have been hundreds of feet underground on the bank of what once had been a prehistoric river. Long before the last ice age, well before 10,000 B.C. Now, the first white men to reach the Dakotas were startled to find a tribe of Indians, call themselves the Mandans. They lived in well-planned villages around which they erected deep-set log stockades, unlike any other tribe in the New World. They were lighter skinned than other North American natives, and many of them were said to have blue-gray eyes, which is also not found in most Native American tribes. Now, there are those that believe they're the descendants of a Welsh tribe that came to the New World. Unfortunately, it's impossible to learn the truth because the entire tribe was wiped out by smallpox, another gift of the European. Rancho Lompoc, California. Giant human remains, extremely old, have been dug up. Crittenden, Arizona. Giant remains found in a stone sepulcher. Walkerton, Indiana. A group of amateur, let's be polite and call them investigators, dug into an Indian mound and unearthed the skeletons of 8 prehistoric giants, ranging from 8 to almost 9 feet tall. All wearing copper armor, something that your average Native American did not do. Now, the fact they were wearing copper armor really wasn't surprising. Ancient copper mines extend for hundreds of miles along Lake Superior. And for primitive tribesmen, no one can figure out how they can be so extensive and so well engineered, built by a race that had no clue about engineering in the first place. In fact, most archaeologists do not believe they were Indian mines, because when the first explorers arrived, the Indians knew nothing about copper. The copper mines, or what the copper had been used for.
and there are no indications of permanent settlements anywhere near these mines. Heavener, Oklahoma. There's a tall slab of stone about 10 feet high, 10 feet long, and a foot thick. On one side of it's carved a line of characters that appear to be ruins. They were there when the first explorers reached what's now Oklahoma. And most evidence seems to confirm the fact that they were there when the first Indians arrived. And certainly the Indians didn't go around carving ruins on solid stone. No one has yet figured out who might have did the carving, though there have been legends. Good grief. North Salem, New Hampshire. 22 stone structures, most of them half buried. No one has any idea who built them. Now, they don't fit into the accepted scientific theory of the New World being populated by people that the state of the art was the bow and the arrow. They certainly didn't build stone houses. Is this evidence of an ancient civilization far more advanced than we've ever considered? There are faded stone carvings of a gazelle head and a bull's head, double axes, which is a symbol you find periodically in ancient grave sites in the old world, but not in the new. There's a huge stone slab similar to a sacrificial altar used by many ancient civilizations. The slab weighs about 4 tons, and it's got a drainage groove down one side. There's an ancient well that's been drained. Investigators found at the bottom of the well a flight of stairs going down that were blocked by a cave-in of huge stones. So the question is, what was at the end of those stairs? We'll never know. In 1954, Buttons, North Carolina, an interesting coin was found. The date, if the numbers were a date, was 1215. The characters on the coin appear Arabic in nature. And the condition of the coin indicated it had been where it was found for a very long time. Did it come there before Columbus arrived or after? You know, a number of puzzling coins have turned up in this country. If you go to a museum, you will find almost every museum of any size has in its basement a room full of anomalies. Findings that don't fit in with the accepted timeline arrived at by archaeologists. In 1833, workmen were boring a well near Norfolk, Virginia, and they saw a bit of metal come up on the auger. It was an ancient coin. It was oval-shaped, about the size of an English shilling,
and it was stamped with figures representing hunters or warriors, similar to ancient Roman characters. And we know, we've already talked about at great length, the fact that there was a Roman colony outside of Tucson that flourished for quite a number of years. Sullivan County, Missouri, 1879. A farmer found what turned out to be an ancient ritual mask made of iron and silver. I mean, something like that was far beyond the capabilities of the known Native Americans that inhabited that region. And actually, it didn't fit in with their customs either. In the state of Georgia, a pair of tiny silver crosses were found. Now, this was in the Smithsonian Report from 1881. C.C. Jones wrote the story. These crosses were skillfully made. Each arm of the cross was of equal length. And the inscription was I-Y-N-K-I-C-I-D-U. But the C and the D were reversed. No one's ever discovered where they came from. Davenport, Illinois. A local minister decided to excavate a prehistoric mound. He found stone tablets, the American Antiquarian did a story on that. And according to that story, it said that one of the tablets contains letters and numerals, both Roman and Arabic. The list includes the letters O and F and the Roman numeral 8, V-I-I-I. The second tablet, these are stone tablets, had the letters TF, T-O-W-N-S. Now, the president of the American Antiquarian Society became so interested that he went to the mounds himself and fought mosquitoes while he dug. I mean, for somebody who lives in a proverbial ivory tower, to get out in the field and actually have to slap a mosquito or two is... that shows some serious interest. Now, the president of the American Antiquarian Society was rewarded with several findings that made it even more confusing. He also found some baffling stone tablets in the mounds, covered with Roman numerals, and other characters that seemed to be Phoenician or Arabic. Bradley County, Tennessee. A farmer named J.H. Hooper was intrigued by the peculiar markings on a stone he found on a hillside. And after pondering the mystery for a while, he decided to see if he could find anything else. He found several similar flat stones with alphabetical characters on them. Now, the New York Academy of Sciences got involved in this, and they wrote it up. He also unearthed a lengthy stone wall that had been buried for a very long time. And when he cleared away the earth and debris from his newly found stone wall, he found many signs and numerals that he couldn't begin to read. Well, he notified the local powers that be, and they called in scientists. Subsequent investigation disclosed that the wall had over 800 individual characters cut into the stone. There were moons and stars and geometrical designs. There were likenesses of animals. There's another anachronism that was found by a man named Elwood D. Hummel, not to be confused with Elwood P. Dowell, who was friends with Harvey. He was fishing along the Susquehanna River near his home in Winfield, Pennsylvania. He was a fly fisherman, and sometimes he'd wade out into the shallows. And the Susquehanna's a good place to go fishing. And one day, while he was standing in the shallow water, he glanced down and he noticed a small flat stone that appeared to have some markings on it. He picked it up and saw it was some kind of baked clay covered with tiny figures that he couldn't read. Now, he was busy fishing and he looked at it, and he doesn't know why he dropped it in the pocket of his fishing coat. For 37 years, he kept that baked clay flat stone in his fishing gear. And one day, one of his grandchildren found it. He started using it as a toy. Now, all this handling and over the years polished the stone and made the markings just that much clearer. And the grandfather decided it was time he find out what this thing was. So he sent it to the curator of the Field Museum in Chicago, which was the center of learning for all things ancient. Well, the experts at the Field Museum in Chicago were easily able to identify and translate the little markings. They spelled out the details of a small loan made by an Assyrian merchant in the Turkish kingdom of Cappadocia about 1,800 years before Christ was born. Gando, you've joined us. I appreciate that. The lone ghostman asked if I have any knowledge about Jacques Toussaint Benoit and his research of psychic snails. I read something, but it was so long ago, I don't remember. When you get to be my age, memory is the second thing to go. And you don't remember what the first thing was. But I will do some research, and I'll have that information come Monday. Now, you know, that's the type of question that you could ask at KenHudnellShow.com in the forum and get all kinds of answers. And I'd appreciate if y'all would go over to KenHudnellShow.com. If you sign up, it's free to sign up. And you can get three free ebooks I've written. One is The Secrets of the Nazi Space Program. Another look at the Kennedy assassination is number two. And the third one is Visits from the Dead. That ebook is about 400 pages. And if you want to get more free stuff I've written, for $7.97 a month, you can go to the bronze level. And there's all kinds of things that I'm making available. You'll get new free ebooks every month. Gando has joined. Now, did you go to the bronze level or the free level? Because for the bronze level, you need your credit card, and you pay through ClickBank. I don't even see your card number. But there's a lot of material I'm going to be putting at bronze and silver and gold. In fact, I'm going to do webinars and webisodes that you'll be able to watch at the silver level. And as I talked about last night, I'm going to be putting up classes about how to become published. In fact, if you follow what I lay out, I guarantee you can be published. I've got my 44th book comes out this month.
So what I talk about works. And they sell well. And Gando, I appreciate you signing up at the free level, but I wish you would look at taking it next step. And in fact, if you can get all your friends and relatives to sign up, I'm trying to create an internet community centered around the strange and the unusual. And there's going to be topics posted there that will curl your hair. And there's going to be audio books. There's going to be videos. You name it, it's going to be there. Okay, certainly nobody could explain how a 3,800-year-old tablet wound up in, I'll have to check that out, Ghostman. So no one could explain how that 3,800-year-old tablet wound up in a river in Pennsylvania. In near Mount Carbon, West Virginia, there are some stone ruins that are so old, no one even has a remotest idea of how they got there. There are stone walls that once stood along the mountaintop, and certainly the people that built them clearly knew about stonework and they knew about military strategy. They were placed in such a fashion they were easy to defend. And they survived who knows how many centuries. And where'd the builders go? No one's ever figured that out. Now, this is a question that's puzzled a lot of people. Is it possible for a human being to be suddenly transported great distances, almost instantaneously, without being harmed? One minute you're in the Philippines, next minute you're in Mexico City. Well, this case came from the official records of Mexico, and it's never been solved. Nobody has a clue how it came about. October 25th, 1593, on the plaza before the palace in Mexico City, there was the changing of the guard taking place, which is quite an official event. And oh, Gray Artist, I'm sorry to see you go. It's always nice when you join us. One soldier stood out from the rest, and it was certainly a puzzle to everybody concerned. He was dressed in a very fancy uniform that was different from all the rest. And he carried a different type of weapon. And he was confused as hell. Well, he was immediately taken into custody and taken for questioning. And he told the Mexican officials his name was Gil Perez. And he said, why I was here? I'm trying to do what I was ordered to do. He said, this morning I was ordered to stand guard at the doors of the governor's palace in Manila. Now, I know this is not the governor's palace, and I know certainly this is not Manila. I don't know how I got here, but here I am, and this is a palace of some kind, so I'm trying to do my duty. And then he said, last night the governor of the Philippines had his head cracked with an axe and is dead. Well, the soldier was told he was in Mexico City, which is several thousand miles from Manila, and he certainly wouldn't believe it. He was taken before the viceroy and his council, who was as baffled as the soldier. He was questioned by church authorities and then thrown in jail because they couldn't figure out how he got there. The only possible explanation, assuming he was telling the truth, was he had been transported from Manila to Mexico City literally overnight. An impossibility in 1593. So the only logical assumptions was A, he was a criminal, B, he was an insane person, or C, he was just a liar. But where he got that nifty uniform, nobody knew. For 2 months, that young man stayed in jail in Mexico City, which even then was not a nice place to be, until a ship arrived from the Philippines. And it brought news that the governor had indeed been murdered, and other passengers not only identified the soldier, but recalled seeing him in Manila the day before he was arrested in Mexico City. Well, still not able to figure out what in the hell happened, they recorded all the details of the story and sent him back to Manila on the next ship. You know, the Soviets have done a lot of research on various topics. And one question that the Soviets are said to have answered, is it possible to revive a warm-blooded creature that's been frozen to death? I mean, it's intriguing. It's illogical to assume that that can be done, but apparently there's been a good deal of research. I know the Germans researched that question. They thought it would help pilots who had become frozen either at high altitude or in very cold water. There were a number of stories I remember seeing back in the early 60s that Soviet scientists had succeeded in reviving two salamanders that had been found frozen stiff. And this was in the tundra of Siberia, which, I mean, it gets colder than you can believe in Siberia. Now, these reports were based on articles that had been written up in the Soviet magazine Neva. Now, the Leningrad Institute of Cytology was involved in this research. And, of course, cytology is a branch of biology that deals with structure, life, and the function of living cells. Now, according to the report, these two salamanders were found frozen in Siberia at a depth of about 25 feet. And in Siberia, zero is a warm, balmy day. Theoretically, these salamanders have been dead about 5,000 years. But they were left at room temperature and basically started thawing out. One of them revived and lived about a week. The other was still alive 3 weeks later when it was shipped to the Moscow University. The Soviets later denied the truth of those stories.
But, you know, warm-blooded creatures have been revived after death by freezing, and it was done right here in the United States. April 6, 1935, Los Angeles. Medical researcher by the name of Willard exhibited a tubercular rhesus monkey who had been frozen stiff for 3 days and revived. One of several test animals to survive the freezing. And a lot of volunteers came to offer themselves as test subjects. A Columbia University professor, his son, volunteered and was accepted. But the powers that be stepped in and put a stop to it. So apparently that experiment never took place. You know, I do want to remind everyone that this hour is brought to you by Golden Corral, 7420 North Mesa. They've got a buffet that will absolutely astound you. More food than you'll be able to eat in one setting. You can take the entire family out for dinner and not have to take out a second mortgage to pay for it. They've got a salad bar. They've got a dessert bar that always has fascinating things attached to it. On holidays and weekends, they serve breakfast. Usually starts, I think, about 7:30, and they switch over to lunch about 11. So check it out. And tell them you heard about it on the Ken Hudnall Show, and they'll give you 10% off your bill. Now, that's a limited time offer, so you need to get in there and enjoy. You know, there was in May of 63, Melbourne, Australia Herald had an interesting story. Three astronomers the previous evening had an interesting experience. It was a little bit before 7 p.m. And this was called the best authenticated sighting of UFOs up to that time. Now, the three astronomers, who were fairly prominent in their own right, watched a brightly lighted object moving across the sky. They watched it for a full minute, which with UFOs is basically a long period of time. Orange, red in color, traveling from west to east, a little below the cloud cover. It was not reflecting sunlight. It had its own illumination. Too fast for a balloon, too slow for a meteor, and it didn't leave a visible trail. And it went almost directly overhead of the observatory. So they had an excellent view of it. First thought is they saw a satellite. So they checked the satellite charts and found that none were on a path that would have taken them over that area at that particular time or that particular course. And this object was underneath the cloud cover, which meant it couldn't have been a satellite. And when they finished their report, all three astronomers made an interesting observation. They agreed that whatever it was definitely man-made. Now, these astronomers tried to be thorough. They checked with the Civil Aviation Control Center. There were no planes in the area at that time. They checked with the Royal Australian Air Force, which initially told them no Air Force planes were in the area. And then the following day, they issued a statement saying the astronomers had seen three of their jets in formation
But this was commercial airspace. The military would not have sent military jets into commercial airspace without warning them. So, what did they see? In all likelihood, a UFO. You know, sometimes when we least expect it, we come in contact with the paranormal. There was a real estate agent in New York City. It's about 1953, 54, 55. Her name was Alice Warren. And she was buying an old house that seemed to be in pretty good condition. And she went by the house and she had a key and she went in looking it over. And she had a carpenter going to meet her there to give her an estimate for remodeling. She wanted to, you know, upgrade and update. And the carpenter was running late, so she sat down in a chair in the old kitchen. Yeah, wait on the carpenter. The story was written up in the Philadelphia Inquirer. She'd been sitting there a minute or two, and she was startled by the appearance of a man who walked into the living room without making a sound. And this man, who was dressed in the style of the early 1800s, walked over to her and actually bowed very courteously. And she sat there with her mouth hanging open. I mean, really didn't know what to say. And he said, my name is Dillman. And you're going to buy a house which, if you'll forgive my boldness, has hideous plumbing. And it'll cost you a fortune to replace it. And then he bowed again and walked out of the room back into the hall. And she jumped up to follow him. And by the time she reached the door to the hall, he was gone. So she called a plumbing expert and who came out to the house and carefully examined everything to do with the plumbing in that house and confirmed the warning given by that strange little person. To replace the plumbing would have cost at least $4,000, which was a considerable amount of money in the 1950s. So she gave up the idea of buying the place. And sometimes later, you know, later that story had been, that what happened was preying on her mind, so she did a title search. And discovered that between 1798 and 1808, that house had been owned by a man named John Dillman. Something she did not know at the time. You know, everyone's heard about the Bell Witch, which took place in Tennessee, when a spirit appeared out of nowhere to torment a man named John Bell until his dying day. And poltergeist phenomena, frankly, are fairly common worldwide, but it's really not understood. It has been and still is a mystery. Even though violence is certainly a characteristic. This next story comes from Tennessee again. It was 1962. And there were it was October. Interesting month. The month when the dead are said to rise from their graves to walk among the living. And in Nashville, Tennessee, on 9th Avenue, the home of John Hawkins, a poltergeist came to visit. Mrs. Hawkins was the first one to make contact. She was at home and heard a knocking on the front door. So she opened the door and there was no one there. Of course, she accused her children of playing pranks, but the children all denied being involved. And then while they were standing there in front of her, there was a heavy knocking again. She jerked open the door and there was no one there. But all three children were standing right there with her. Well, this went on, off and on, all day long. And when she told her husband that evening, he, of course, assumed she was imagining things. And the pounding went on all night, so the husband got a good dose of it. It ended shortly after daylight. And when it began on the second night, the family got their guns out. Folks in Tennessee tend to do that if you piss them off. And the knocking was only the beginning of the episode. Then they started hearing the knocking all over the house. First the front door, and then the side door, and then the back door. So hard the glass in the door would rattle. Sometimes the knocking started at dark and lasted till 5 or 6 in the morning. The police were called, and they posted men all around the house, but the pounding continued, and the police didn't see a thing. Typical. Once when the rapping came from a window pane, a friend of the family fired a shot through the window. The rapping just transferred to another window pane nearby. On another night, 20 football players from North High School sat on the porch, and that didn't solve anything. The knocking just moved around the house. For more than 2 months, this went on. Mr. Hawkins later said it didn't hurt anything, but we just can't get any sleep. Now, the interesting thing that was noticed about this poltergeist event in Nashville, as well as a number of others around the country, was in each case, there was the presence of teenage children. Perhaps they're the spark. Certainly they were not the culprits. You know, there's a lot of mysteries that give us food for thought. Owensville, Indiana. One winter morning, the citizens were very surprised to find a message painted in large letters on the sidewalk in front of the local elementary school. It said, "Remember Pearl Harbor." Now, people commented on the message. They didn't know who put it there. They didn't know why. And it wasn't anything to get excited about at the time. Pearl Harbor was December 7th, 1941. This message, "Remember Pearl Harbor," was painted on the sidewalk one winter morning in 1939. Did someone foresee a devastating attack? You know, sometimes dreams are said to be the subconscious dealing with issues that came rows during the day. At other times, there seems to be a logic to the dream. Jones and Laughlin Steel Company in Pittsburgh have been having a problem. The problem was a major switch on a 10-inch bar mill. For 2 years, they had spent time and money on this problem. They had offered to switch 11 times, and it still didn't work. No one could figure out how to solve this matter. There was a roller working in the mill by the name of Ray Hammerstrom. Now, he wasn't, a brilliant engineer. He wasn't an expert in bar mills. One afternoon in August of 1955, he laid down for a nap, and while napping, he had a dream. And he clearly saw the design of a new switch to replace the one that was giving trouble. As soon as he woke up, he got a piece of paper and he sketched out that switch. And it worked perfectly. Got a $15,000 reward from the company. That's a dream that paid off. Margaret Moyat was an English artist and a very good one by all reports. She painted hundreds of portraits during her career. But the one for which she is best known, hello there, Jeff, what's going on? Is a portrait that has never been explained. Story began one morning in June of 53. Miss Moyat awoke. She lived in Eythorne, Kent, in England. And she'd had a very vivid dream. She had had a dream about a very striking individual. But it was someone she knew she hadn't seen before, an elderly man. He just stood there in the dream right in front of her as though he expected her to do his portrait. And the impression he left when she awoke was so strong that she got up and started painting that figure before the little image faded. Took her 2 days to finish that portrait. About 2 weeks after she finished the portrait, she had a couple of guests, and they were two ladies who had lived in Eythorne for more than 30 years. And in her studio, she had that picture on display, and when the two saw it, they were stunned. And they called friends, and those friends came to look at it, and they were just blown away by that portrait. As I said, that's the one that she is most known for. And everyone agreed that that was the unmistakable likeness of a former minister of Eythorne, a man by the name of Hughes. And the friends who were called in called other friends, and the story spread far and wide. Now, at the time she painted that portrait, Miss Moyat had lived in Eythorne only 2 years. Mr. Hughes was the local Baptist minister. And she wasn't Baptist, and she had never heard of Reverend Mr. Hughes. In fact, at the time she had that dream and painted that painting, Mr. Hughes had been dead for 25 years. And yet, it was a spitting image. I tell you, some of the stories just absolutely baffle. There's many evidence of paranormal via psychic dreams and there are other psychic experiences. Well, you're right, Lone Ghostman. There's quite a bit of evidence that psychic dreams are a reality. There was a woman. She was a young woman, married. She was driving a new sedan, and she was just letting her rip. She was actually going too fast for the conditions because it was cold and there was ice beneath a thin covering of snow. And the nearby river was deep and swift, and it ran right beside the highway. Well, she was so enjoying the sensation of driving that car that she didn't realize her danger until it was too late. She took a death grip on the wheel and slammed on the brakes and tried to turn the car away from the river. Its front wheels turned on the icy roadway, but she didn't have a chance. The sedan spun around once, straightened, and then went right through the barrier and into the river. Sank like a rock. Twenty-three-year-old Mrs. Fred Corday of Marathon, New York, never had a chance. This was 1938. The only thing left were the tire marks that had knocked away the snow from the ice-covered highway. For 7 days, volunteer search parties probed the river. They found the car, but her body wasn't there. Well, they never found the body, at least in the river or in the car. And they finally decided they might as well give up and wait for the thaw. Have you heard of the intervention paradox? I can't say that I have. I have to look that up. Those that have been involved in searching for the woman figured that the swiftly moving river had washed her body downstream and they'd have to wait until it came to light. Well, at that point in time, a truck driver came forward with a suggestion. He told the police he didn't know the victim, but he had twice seen her body in a singularly vivid and gruesome dream. And the picture in that dream had been so unforgettable that he felt he could find that spot. Well, police are hesitant about accepting outsiders. They're very clannish as well. Now, we've all heard of psychics who help police solve cases, but this man wasn't even a psychic. He was a truck driver. So finally, he convinced them. And they followed him along the riverbank until they came to the spot he'd seen in his dream. Now, they knew there was a strong likelihood they'd be the laughingstock of the community if this truck driver couldn't find the body.
So only a few went with the driver, and even they certainly had strong reservations about the wisdom of doing this. And of course, following the group was a crowd of the curious, as always happens. And as the truck driver walked along the riverbank, they thronged around him. Finally, he stopped. He was 2 miles downstream from the place where they'd been working on searching for the body. And he pointed to two huge trees that hung out over the stream. And he said, "There, right between those two trees, there's where I saw her body. About 50 feet from the bank and between those two trees in the river eddy." In the Adventure Paradox, where one can change one's own future by having knowledge of a future event before the event takes place. Well, certainly, if you had knowledge of an event before it took place, you can change it. But then again, there is the argument that destiny will make sure the event happens, whether when it's supposed to or at some other point in time, it will happen. Well, the river was coated with ice at the point where he was pointing, and the workers used ice saws and axes to hack out a hole in the ice about 100 feet long and 4 feet wide. Now, most of them were feeling pretty damn foolish, for this spot was so well off the main current that they, where they estimated the body to be found, but less than 1 hour after they began to drag that spot, one of the members of the search party located the body at a place they knew it couldn't be because of a dream of a truck driver. Well, we got about 3 minutes before it's time for me to play my theme music. You know, the nights I get to sit and tell the stories are nights I enjoy. I hope you all like the stories, because it gives me the opportunity to dredge up some that I've heard years before and you know, barely remember. I would like to urge everyone to go to Ken Hudnall Show, KenHudnallShow.com. You can sign up for free. There are 3 free ebooks you can download and enjoy. And if you like what you read, then I recommend you go back and sign up for the bronze level. There's the free level, bronze, silver, and gold. And at each level, there are more freebies. You'll get far more than the cost at each level. $7.97 is the bronze level, $7.97 a month. And you'll get newsletters. Having a psychic dream of seeing yourself in a car crash and taking action to avoid it. That's true. Jeff, I hope you enjoyed the stories. Monday night, of course, my guest is Yoli, and she'll be talking about what the future holds. On the 18th, the show moves to the Paranormal Soup Network. We'll have a better chat room, better phone system, clearer sound, and no idiots. So, you know, I hate it when they disrupt, but I can only do so much. Well, it's been an interesting evening. I've enjoyed talking about the stories. If anyone's got any questions, we got about a minute before I have to start my theme music. No? No questions? Well, I thank you all for being with me. It's always fun. We're going to have some interesting guests next week. And, in fact, Joseph Farrell will be here on Wednesday talking about the Third Reich and Roswell. So until Monday night at 6 o'clock, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening. And a great weekend.